Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we make our appeals to heaven, we need to continue to learn, pray, and act, as well as focus on the Constitution. Now, as we were going through the debates in Congress, we kind of went through the very first conversation that they had regarding the Western lands and how the federal government was going to fulfill their role and responsibility in handling the territories. Now, they had the ability to make the needful rules and regulations while the land was a territory. Once that land became a state, now the state would have the benefit of selling that land, that unappropriated land, and be able to, you know, make money for themselves. Now, the federal government doesn't allow that anymore. As a matter of fact, all land that's not appropriated, the state doesn't even make any money off of it. Well, I guess that's probably different between one state and the other. But let me just dive into the very ending part, because we were just wrapping up on Thursday, May 28th, when they were talking about Western lands. And so basically they decided on the motion to kind of create a subcommittee, and the committee consisting of Messrs. Scott, Huntington, and Sherman. Messrs. Scott, Huntington, and Sherman were the four representatives in the House of Representatives that were appointed to this subcommittee. Now, they pause and dive into a plethora of subjects, and as a matter of fact, as we kind of look at what they paused from 420 from that point of Western lands, collection of revenue, the amendments, and then they started dealing with the Secretary of Foreign Affairs. At this point, on page 475, they started talking with Thomas Jefferson regarding the Department of Foreign Affairs and talking with him. And so from 475 all the way through the pages of the 500, in other words, if I looked at what that was, May something, and then we go into 500, then into 600, it wasn't until 609 where they established what they were going to talk about next. And as a matter of fact, let me see that. That would be page 4, because there's two pages per page, as much as that may sound interesting. This is June 23rd. So they've been dealing with the Secretary of Foreign Affairs as well as the Department of Foreign Affairs for about a month, going through these conversations and so forth. Now, they picked back up Western lands. Now, let me make sure that Western lands, is it actually anywhere else in the 400s? Because I thought there may have been one other mention of Western lands. Nope. So the first time the Western lands comes back up is literally 645. So this is when we go to page 22, and so the Western lands actually shows up on page 645. Remember, two pages per sheet. So as you're playing with this, you can see that when you're looking at one page, you actually see both pages, and there's a divider. I've mentioned this before. When you look at the records of Congress, they have one page in one column, then they have another page. In the newer records that they kept, they literally put three pages on a page. So, not to confuse things. So now we're talking July 13th. So we're in the heat of summer. And actually, this is New York, where they're meeting the very first year. And so this is how they picked this motion, or I should say this topic, back up. The House resolved itself into a committee of the whole on the State of the Union, Mr. Benoit in the chair. Mr. Scott requested that the report of the committee on the Western Territory might be read, which was read accordingly as follows. Resolved that it is the opinion of this committee, this is the subcommittee, that an act of Congress should pass for establishing a land office and to regulate the terms of granting vacant and unappropriated lands in the Western Territory. Mr. Scott, in endeavoring, sir, this is what Mr. Scott says, in endeavoring, sir, to open the interesting subject now before you, I shall avoid the repetition of those ideas which I threw out on a former occasion, as far as my memory will serve me, and the nature of the subject will permit. This subject, sir, will appear of great magnitude in point of interest if we consider the extent of the territory. I think it shall not be far beyond the mark if I say it is 1,000 miles long and 500 broad, nor if I say it is sufficient to contain 2 millions of farms. Nevertheless, for greater caution, say it would contain 1 million, which is notoriously greater within the real contents, and that each of these farms may be peopled by 6 souls. They will amount to 6 million of inhabitants, doubling the number of the present inhabitants of the United States. From this view, it is an object of great concern. It will appear also an object of concern if we contemplate the climate, the soil, and the waters of that country. Consider that it lies in the heart of the temperature zone. Its soil infinitely more rich and more fertile than in the Atlantic states. Its waters pure and good. And in a word, it is such a territory as must command inhabitants and will be peopled. Its situation in the middle of our continent gives the climate a salubatory that accommodates it. I have no idea what salubriety. I think salubriety. That, and I have no idea. I have to look these words up too, folks. That accommodate it to the immigrant from both northern and southern states. It is meeting them on a middle ground, softening the harsh restrictions of the rugged north and breathing bland and zephyr grateful to the sun-scorched south. In short, it is as such gives us all who have seen it the utmost satisfaction in both its healthy and agreeable. If we consider the source of wealth in that country, we shall at the present moment view it all as a subject of no inconsiderable magnitude. From the country it has been drawn, and hereafter may be drawn, considerable quantities of the most valuable exports of our country affords. But of this gentleman in trade can give you a better account than I shall pretend to do. But I am of the opinion the trade and furs and peltry it produces are of great consequence to our commerce. Now, as I was reading this, I was thinking, you know, when America got started in the early 1600s, when the English migration of people in 1602 started, people came here and the land was claimed by the king. And so a person, basically the king, had kind of an investment in these companies of going out and creating these settlements. These settlements would then create parcels of land after they created their own plantations. People would then come here and work on those plantations where they would make money as well as earn a parcel of land that would be then granted to that person. All in the while, the king is making the big stipend. In other words, the king is siphoning off of this. The monarch is siphoning off of this for his benefit. And the people in America were able to pocket more than they were able to pocket in Britain, which is one of the reasons why a lot of people saw the advantage, especially those who had the moral motivation of getting away from religious persecution or whatever ideological problems they had while living under the rule of thumb, or I should say the rule of the king, I don't know if you know what a rule of thumb means, but in the old days, a rule of thumb was actually a law that we had in America, and it probably came from England as well, that, and don't hate me, folks, I'm just telling you, the rule of thumb stems from a law that a man could beat his woman, his wife, with a stick that could be no greater than the diameter of his thumb. And he could do that in public on the stairs or at the steps or at you know, in the presence of the, you know, the city halls, you know, the governing building of the area, county, what have you. So anyway, that way it was a legal administering of a capital punishment, not capital, but a corporal punishment. Anyway, so as we kind of look at how things transition from how the king was getting rich off the expanse of America, and what's interesting, 100-some-odd years later, almost 200 years later, the king and Britain had started becoming so strapped that they made the decision in the 1760s and 1763 is when the rule came out, but they started making this decision that the colonies of America would start paying for most of the operations of the wars and those types of things that the king had kind of been squandering his money, his, I should say, his holdings. So when they did that, that became so precious. I mean, history was written based on that, that we actually revolted and we broke away. So as we look at how things were really going good, had the king not been so greedy, and had the king not had probably a mental breakdown, because King George had a mental breakdown, I think that we would probably look at, you know, things a lot differently. But nevertheless, as we revolted and we moved forward, now there was an opportunity, because remember, Continental Congress had no way in the Articles of Confederation, they had no way of being responsible for the territories, of having that stewardship and bringing them into the states. Now, I believe, had the states held the federal government accountable, I believe that they probably would have dragged their feet in making states states instead of hurrying to bring them in. I don't know. I think that they were kind of at a, well, actually history proves that over the first four, actually maybe eight states that they brought into the Union, and I hate to say, I hate to even guess at that. So the best thing to do is to actually look at the statehood order and basically tell you that as we look at Vermont, Kentucky, Tennessee, Ohio, Louisiana, then to Indiana, they had admitted, what is that, five states into the Union in a hurry. What I mean by that is they just kind of quickly brought them in because they needed the revenue. And I think as states actually kept on maintaining, oh, we want to become a part of the Union with the Indiana Enabling Act. I've said this time and time again. It all started with Indiana when the federal government started encroaching on states as they joined the Union, saying, you don't have your soil rights. You really don't have full sovereignty. We're keeping these few things from you. And every state that joined the Union, it got more and more out of hand. They used the Northwest Ordinance to do this. So as we look at Louisiana joining, and then, what, 4 years later, Indiana's coming in. I think that this was a, you know, they didn't want to not have Indiana come in, because then they could start apportioning taxation on the state for, you know, its GDP, the state making money and the state's commerce and so forth. They say, okay, you give us, you know, this much, or they basically apportion it out to all the states that, you know, based on your population, you give us this much per head. However they did it now, whatever those things were, there was a drive to getting states into the Union so that the federal government could make more money to pay off its debt. Especially by 1812, the interest of getting, you know, more states into the Union, which actually we can see going from Indiana, and we go all the way to the 1830s, actually to 1821, 6 states joined the Union in just a few years. And all 6 of these states started getting, I'll just say, holdbacks. The federal government started holding back sovereignty. It just minor in Indiana, but with Mississippi, big time. That's when they started applying the Northwest Ordinance to the states in the South. How in the heck did that happen? The Northwest Ordinance was completely superseded by the Constitution. How did they pull that out of their back pocket? And by this point in time, nobody was the wiser. I mean, shoot, the Northwest Ordinance was 30 years ago, right? 1787. So 97-07-17, that's 30 years. So when they started using it, everybody goes, well, what the heck is that? Who knew about that? That is a generation has passed out of the halls of Congress. Madison was just retiring as the president. And so most of the young kids in Congress and most of the younger people, they were completely unaware of what the heck was going on. So let me get back into where we are. It will appear further to be a subject worthy of our consideration if we attend to the profit already derived to the United States from the sale of soil, from the sale of land, and which may be extended to any degree whatever. This is to provide a valuable source of relieving the embarrassments to which the United States are subjected to. But a very inconsiderable part of the soil, and that far from being the most excellent, has been disposed of, yet the sale of amounts to 4,936,863 land for almost 5 millions of specie dollars has already been sold in that district, a sum amounting near one-fifth to more than one-sixth of the whole domestic debt of the United States. Do you hear the light just happen? You hear what just happened? Click. The light just went on that when they look at the domestic product and the domestic debt, land was how they were going to get out of debt quickly. This treasure which we possess has done this much towards extinguishing the debt, bearing hard upon every part of the Union. Okay, so most people say that we haven't been paying the debt, or that we were not paying the debt, we were just paying England. No. There's no there that we were subjects of England under this Constitution. None. Zero. We weren't abiding by the treaty, nor was England. As a matter of fact, when we go into this further and further, we're going to realize that England has been basically not abiding by the treaty. We weren't abiding by it either. We covered this already. So the fact that people are coming up and saying, oh, wow, you know, America, when the Constitution went into effect, we were all subjects of England. No. There may have been people operating independently with, you know, intent to do bad things, but that was not what was created. The Constitution was a limited and defined government that protected the sovereignty of the states, the Union, and of the people, period. And the government at that point in time could not operate outside of that. What had to happen is that they had to start assuming powers. They had to start assuming, you know, these roles, responsibilities, powers, properties, and so forth that they did not have delegated. And I'm here to tell you that that doesn't mean what they were doing was legitimate. The Constitution made it impossible for them to do what everybody is telling you they did. In other words, it wasn't done legitimately. So whenever anybody comes along and tells you that the Constitution is the problem, that our government, we the people, and the people that are in our government may be acting bad, but that doesn't mean that those seats are illegitimate. It doesn't mean they don't have actual legitimate roles and responsibilities. They're just performing roles and responsibilities, powers, and so forth that they don't actually have. In other words, they're defrauding you and I, and they're doing things outside of their granted authority. So moving on, it goes on and says, have any of the states done as much? Have any of them made an exertion equal to this inconsiderable effort? No, they have not. Have all the states together done as much? No, they are incapable of doing what this wilderness has done. This consideration alone renders it an interesting subject of immense future consequences and worthy of the immediate attention of Congress. We may further that besides the sales which we have made satisfactory donations to the officers and soldiers of the late army, which may be fairly carried to swell the account, but after all, this, the parts we have disposed of, bear no proportion of the parts yet remaining, and from which money may be drawn. Can we hesitate then to call for an operation, call into operation a fund so immense and important to the immediate interests of the United States? So the epiphany's happening, folks. Hey, America can be for sale. We're going to start selling America. Now, again, they brought in a few states pretty quickly, very quickly. Louisiana was one of those states, and Ohio was another one, along with Vermont, Tennessee, and Kentucky, right? So moving on, he says, if we place it in another point of view, it will also appear a subject in which the United States are deeply engaged in a point of national honor and good faith. The officers and soldiers to whom we have made donations and a part of the price of their blood and reward for their long enduring toils and pain, suffering in the noblest causes, the freedom of their country, and certainly entitled to the fatherly assistance of a Congress in point of protection. Now, they were obligated to those people who they made a contract with. If you would, sign up and protect us, we will, we'll give you these things. Those were basically labor contracts that they went into that they were obligated to pay, not just obligated to pay the debts to the other nations. The greatest debt that they had was to the veterans. And so can it be thought without an outrage to humanity that Congress intended to send them into the wilderness as outcasts from society, that the hand of government should not be extended to them to protect them in their lives and property, that our gift was an abandonment, was an allurement to draw them without shelter and leave them devoid of those blessings which their successful efforts had secured to us. My spirit rises indignant at the unjust suspicion. But these are not the only circumstances in which the honor of Congress is engaged to extend its fostering care into that country. It expressly stipulated by Congress with the state of Virginia that the French and Canadians and other ancient settlers within her cession should be protected and governed by Congress. These were among the other terms agreed to by Congress when the conveyance of that territory was made, and Congress, by that act, plighted the good faith of the Union for the faithful performance thereof. People have gone upon those lands and have been regularly purchased and have paid for. They are consequently entitled to look to us for protection in their property. A due observance. Now, see, I've got a real problem with this guy talking, because he's saying that the federal government is to protect them. Yes, in the form of a militia, that their first defense is their internal militia. They don't talk about this. Now, I have to go back through, because there has been conversations already with the War Department. Was there anything that alluded to that? And maybe in the Secretary of Foreign Affairs, was there anything in there that was talking about the development of the national security system, the national defense system, that every state would actually basically establish their own militia and ensure that they have the ability to protect themselves? With that, we'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me get back to this. They're claiming that the United States has the responsibility in protecting them. Well, they don't have the authority to have a standing army. So what gives? Where are they getting this authority from? I'm here to tell you folks that the states have the responsibility themselves to protect themselves. And Congress failed to do this. Now this goes into this, you know, the ability to manipulate government by using, I'll just say, these types of dependencies. Oh, well, you're dependent on us. You need us. Let's move forward. Due observance of the treaties heretofore entered into with Indian tribes must be enforced if the country is settled by a lawless banditti. They will keep the nation in a perpetual broil with the savages. Therefore, the guidance of the United States must go with the settlers in order to procure the observance of such treaties. This is a future obligation in point of national honor and good faith, under which we lie with respect to that country. I am likewise of opinion that we shall find it a subject of considerable magnitude in point of policy. I presume the first two points will be readily given up because they are incontrovertibly established by the facts, but I feel aware that at the point of policy may be contended with me, it may perhaps be objected that the measure now proposed will lead or tend to a depopulation of the Atlantic states and therefore ought not to be adopted. This is a circumstance by which no means wish. I am far from designing, or what is this? Well, it doesn't come in very clear. So these are bad types, or I should say, these are typed documents that they did later on. And sometimes you get this word that the part of the letter just doesn't come out. And from, okay, I think this might be devising a depopulation of the Atlantic shores. As I am from fearing it on this grounds, I am confident that it will not operate in any considerable degree to bring that event, but if it should be thought, it would be that that could be no solid objection against the measure. Whilst the desire of immigration continues and lands are to be procured, settlers will find their way into that territory, nor is it the power of Congress to withhold lands altogether, because they are to be got of others on better terms. There is a superior encouragement held out to the people settling on the land of the river Mississippi, where the soil is fertile and the climate equally agreeable. In proof of this assertion, I will read to the committee the translation of a kind of proclamation issued by the governor of the Spanish posts at the Illinois. This paper contains an invitation to all persons inclined to settle in the Western country, offering as an inducement lands without charge, exemptions from taxes, protection in civil and religious liberties, besides provision and the implements of husbandry. After this, Mr. S. Now, what is Mr. S.'s name? I think this is Mr. Scott. I believe this is Mr. Scott that started reading this. I got to go all the way up to the beginning. Yes, Mr. Scott. So Mr. Scott, saying Mr. S., Mr. Scott proceeded, "Now, sir, if Congress fear to sell their lands leased at 10 to depopulate the Atlantic states, what must they apprehend from propositions like these? They will certainly have all the effect which encouragement from this quarter can have. It may be said that Americans will not venture to live under the Spanish government or settle a colony. To this, it may be replied that when people from their necessity or inclinations are determined to immigrate in order to mitigate their distress, they think little of the form of government. All they care for is relief from their present or approaching wants and troubles. Nobody will immigrate from the Atlantic states but a certain description of men, and they will go whether you hold out this encouragement to them or not. They will pay little regard to congressional restrictions, and here let me make one remark. Drawn from my own observation, the forming settlements in the wilderness upon the frontiers between the savages and the least populated of the civilized parts of the United States requires men of enterprising, violent, nay, discontented, and turbulent spirits. Such always are the first settlers in the ruthless and savage wild. They serve as pioneers to clear the way for the mere laborious and careful farmer. These characters are already in that country by thousands, and their number is daily increasing and will continue to increase, for congenial spirits will assimilate Magure, M-A-U-G-R-E, all our endeavors to the contrary. But how will you prevent them? I should be glad to see a plan for hemming in the immigration to that territory. I think the thing wholly impracticable. Therefore, it becomes an immediate interest of Congress to direct the immigration of a proper point, direct it to their own territory, rather than to be inactive spectators of its silent, though rapid course to the Spanish and British dependencies. Rather sell your lands and get something for them than let your citizens leave your dominions by improving a part to add to the value of the remainder. Their population will produce a hardy race of husbandmen and warriors always at the command of the United States to support and defend your liberty and property. These being facts, I leave to the wisdom of the House to draw inference. I will make one further remark with respect to the encouragement or discouragement of immigration. Suppose it was in the power of Congress to stop the course of impetuous current, which has already won its way through its insuperable obstructions and spread itself over the fertile lands of Ohio. I ask with perfect security, if it is not such an act continuous and inconsistency with the fundamental... Yeah, that's interesting. Cotimacy and inconsistency with the fundamental principles of the government that Congress could not adopt it. Consider that many of your citizens are destitute of the comforts, nay, the common necessities or necessaries of life. It should be necessities, but not they got necessaries of life without a prospect of providing for the subsistence of themselves and families. I ask, would Congress prevent the immigration of such persons if they could? I think not. They would not act, as kind, protecting fathers to their people if they did. I presume this would be a too serious of an objection for any man with restraining propositions. I question if any man would be heartily enough to point out a class of citizens by name that ought to be the servants of the community, yet unless that is done, to what class of people could you direct such a law? But if you pass such an act, it would be tantamount to saying that there is some class which must remain here and by law must be obliged to serve the others for such wages as they please to give. In other words, basically conscripting people. This being the case, let us make the best of liberty, our people, and our land. Your citizens, I tell you, are already there by thousands. They are going by thousands more. And every hour growing up into consequence, they never expect to return to the Atlantic states, plant themselves in your soil, add this wealth of population to your own, and form an empire illustrious as it is extended. Remember, ye sages of my country, an historic truth recorded for your instruction, that empire has been slowly but invariably moving from east to west. Immigration has uniformly receded in that direction from the time of our common parents quitted the Garden of Eden till the present hour, nor doubt but it will continue to pursue that course as long as the lands are inhabited. Those people, Mr. Chairman, who are there growing up must be provided with a government in that country. Perhaps to this may be objected, and they will long be continue in union with us. Perhaps arguments may be brought from the other side of the Atlantic and will be told with confidence that an extension of territory is infallible, the ruin of kingdoms. For examples, in support of this opinion, we may be carried as far back as the 11th epoch of Romans. And there we may learn from judicious writers that the weight of the distant provinces brought about the fall of that empire. Now, I've mentioned this before, that Britain, when we went into the Revolutionary War with Britain, they were already spread too thin. They had so much debt, they've done too many things, that by this point in time, they had to spend, you know, the king's savings on paying for mercenaries, paying for the Scots to basically be deployed into America to fight us so that we would still be a part of England. This was a huge mistake that the king made. He could have easily not spent a penny, maintained taxes in America by granting us representation in Parliament. You really just said the king made a huge strategical error. He made a huge mistake where his pride and the pride of Parliament basically felt that they had us wrapped around their finger, that we would be too dependent on them, that we wouldn't risk our lives, we wouldn't risk our honor in trying to sever ourselves from them. And so they made that decision, and they said, okay, we're going to continue to oppress you. And because they oppressed us, we revolted, they lost everything, and all the money they spent, they lost. Then they went and spent another, I don't know how much money. I'd like to actually see the cost of the British Empire in the revolution, the cost of money they lost in trying to basically force us to stay. And then the money they lost in trying to invade us in 1812 to take us back. They have been spending and spending and spending money, you know, that they've had to borrow or they've had to steal, they've had to kill others to basically try to undo what we did. And even though on the face of it they never did, under the undercurrents in our government and in our politics, they have created an illegitimate siphon of basically controlling us and siphoning money off from us and creating this unholy alliance with all the rest of the world. Therefore, I'm here to tell you folks that this has never been done legitimately, that the only legitimate thing we have is we the people, this fact that we have a constitution that's very limited in this framework, and that the government can only do those things. Now, as we, let me get back to this. And so let me kind of pick it up from where I kind of left off. Now, if I could grant this to be a fact, which I cannot, for I rather attribute that event to the pernicious privileges granted and the immense sums thrown away on the capital of Constantinople. While the preservation of the ancient city was so difficult, and the division of the empire among the children and nephews of Constantine, but if it could be attributed to the extent of her territory, the comparison does not hold. The foundation of the Roman Empire was laid upon fraud, rapine, and murder. They conquered, and their footsteps were marked with blood of men more civilized than themselves, or they, with their wives and daughters, were carried captives and sold at the shambles of Rome. Their territory was laid waste, and colonies of children purchased of their parents were founded upon their ruin. Was it to be supposed that men would bear this savage barbarity longer than the arm of victory was pressing on them? Is this manner in which we propose to settle the Western country? The comparison is too odious to be insisted upon. There is a striking difference between the government of the United States and that of the Roman provinces. The citizens of the first are bound together in the bond of equal liberty, and every state possesses within itself independent powers necessary to its support. So why does he think that the territories, or these new areas as they become states, would need more support? The wretched inhabitants of the Roman provinces were the abject slaves of their lordly masters, who seldom behaved with moderation. Their history is nothing but a serious injustice, more or less disguised. Another instance may perhaps be drawn from the separation of this continent from Great Britain. Here I would make two remarks. The first is that the Atlantic Ocean of 3,000 miles extent formed such a natural boundary as to be the reason for separation when we should be prepared for it. The second is that even this natural boundary did not furnish the reason for our independence. We were driven into that measure by necessity. Our separation was brought about by the impolicy and the oppressions of Great Britain. She wished to deprive us of the fruits of our industry by establishing the doctrine and omnipotence of Parliament, and wanted to attach us to them as provinces of slaves. I will say that if like a conduct were to be placed on our part with respect to the Western country, similar effects might ensue. But this can hardly happen under a government funded upon the true principles of democracy. Besides, I think we have a sufficient lesson before our eyes to guard us against the attempt. Much will depend upon the energy and force of the government established in that country. It ought to be such as will furnish sufficient power for its own internal purposes, and also to secure it to the Union. But that it is not only tie by which it is which its union is held. That country is attached to the Atlantic States by its natural situation. To be convinced of this truth, no thing more is necessary than to look upon the chart. All of the commerce of that country must come through the States upon the sea coast. We know at Pittsburgh that there are 1,000 miles nearer to the market than settlers at the mouth of the Ohio River. When we export our produce to that land, the Mississippi, we know we can get easier home with our returns by the way of Philadelphia than the others can by turning up and stemming the current of the Mississippi. Therefore, the imports for all that territory must come through the United States. From these considerations, I conclude, at least at that point in time, as the expanse would occur more and more, those types of things would change, like steamboats and so forth. From these considerations, I conclude that would be madness in the extreme for them to think of separation unless they were driven to it by a fatal necessity. They will be too sensible of its ill effects ever to attempt it. But suppose for a moment that they break off from the Union and even become our enemies, it would be a good policy to us to get as much as we can from them first, especially as they are disposed to give it to us. Let us make them extinguish part of that national debt before they leave us. So basically, let's take advantage of them at least. The soil and the climate of that country, as I said before, will be great inducements for immigrants to settle there. If they were to break off, they would know how to get money enough from the sale of the territory to support their government without any form resource whatever. If I, as a resident in that country, had the remotest view of a separation from the Atlantic states, I would be sorry to see Congress sell an acre of that land, for selling it in that case would be neither more nor less than preventing us from putting the money into our pockets when we became independent. If they mediate independency, the most likely way to make them so will to be let their lands alone in order to supply them with the funds sufficient to support them in the measure if they are sold, it will not be in their power. Another consideration which shows the subject to be of great consequence to the Union is the sales already made there. A partial mention of which I made in one of my former observations, by the terms of those sales, the United States are obliged to complete the surveys. This has not hitherto been done. Of consequence, the money due for them cannot be had, nor the accumulating interest is be suspended. The amount, as I stated before, is near $5 million of dollars of this sum. $771,000 has been paid, plus cents, or plus dollars, paid into the Treasury. The whole of the remainder will continue unpaid till the surveys are completed, namely the $4,165,553, paying a daily interest of $684. This, gentlemen, is what we actually lose every day for want of establishing some regulations on the subject. See, he's putting it down into money sense now. Is not this a matter of serious concern to the people of the United States, which requires our immediate attention? Then if this is the case, if the subject of such vast magnitude in all points of view, it only remains to consider what is to be done with respect to it to procure the greatest good to the United States and the greatest benefit to the people. I apprehend it will be found that a land office will affect these subjects better than any other plan that can be devised. If this should be effectual, and no doubt can be entertained by it, will the inhabitants of the United States cannot, with a good grace, be called for a heavy taxes in order to pay the interest on a debt which can be so easily and properly extinguished? Every individual who contemplates the subject will see how much it is his interest to buy a few dollars in certificates and purchase a piece of land with them, which will annihilate the debt and prevent the demand for taxes to pay the interest. Besides, it will remain as a security to reimburse the principal to the proprietor as the population of the country extends. But at all events, it would be but advancing 4 or 5 years interest, and the whole debt would be absorbed. How much better is this than paying interest during our lives and leaving our children to the discharge of principal and continue on their own shoulders the burden of annual interest of 6%? The view of this subject would be, it would appear, every man's interest to become a purchaser in that country. This mixing of the interest would incorporate the body to tend to increase the bands of the union. It will occasion ties to consanguinity and affinity upon us or among us, which had added the similarity of laws, customs, and manners, will form in inseparable cement and compress the whole into the closet union, or into the closest union. I'm sorry. If it should be thought inconvenient for the citizens in the Atlantic states to purchase so largely, I have intimated let them lay out but the amount of 1 year's tax in this way, and it will nearly extinguish the domestic debt, for which otherwise they will have to pay annually forever an equal sum to what I propose for them, advanced by the establishment of land office, such purchasers could be supplied. Now, with 2 minutes left, there's kind of a large paragraph, so I'm going to leave that right there, and we'll pick this back up on Friday. The fact of the matter is, folks, the case is clear that the federal government had a responsibility in tending to these territories, making sure that they, because they did have the responsibility, because these territories were theirs. They're their claims, and with the Louisiana Territory, they paid money for that. And so they had a responsibility and stewardship to ensure that these territories transitioned into states. So at this point in time, that was their focus. I don't believe at this point in time they started thinking nefariously. Now, there may have been somebody in the back room like Hamilton, somebody else down the road that actually started connecting the dots to say, we can start playing, we can do things that we don't have the power to do and really take advantage of it and slowly but surely work our way around to subjugating the states to us. All of which, outside of an amendment, makes it illegitimate. There's the word. It makes it all illegitimate. Unless there's an amendment that is granted that power, that role, responsibility, whatever it is that they've done and they're doing. If there's no amendment, it's illegitimate. It's fraud. It's that simple. So as we go through this, let me see. I think we've got probably a few more pages, right? And let me see here. I got one, two, we've got about 2.5 pages, almost three. No, actually, if one side's a page, that's one, two, three. Yeah, we got about 4 pages. We got about 4 pages to go through. So when we come back on Friday, we'll try to wrap this up, because then we'll get into the Home Department, because just in a few more weeks, as Congress meets and they do these other things, they will meet again and they will start to initiate the Home Department. With that, folks, that's where they laid the foundation for later for them to come back around and break through the Constitution. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.